I could have just as easily called my talk to you today, When Political Leaders Become Priests or Pastors. Okay, and I chose this topic because it's an issue I deal with a lot in the classroom. And so it's one, frankly, that I could talk to you for many hours on without having to worry about it a whole lot, because I teach this issue all the time. I teach the Renaissance and the Reformation, and of those two courses, the most difficult is the Reformation. Why is it the most difficult? Because it is the most baffling to students. The Renaissance is not a problem for them. The rise of the Western world to the obvious superiority as far as they're concerned, and great paintings of naked people all over cathedrals in, you know, Rome, no problem, easy to get at. The Reformation is difficult, and it's difficult probably for a reason that might seem strange to you. It's not the theology. One of the things about being in Orange County that's very interesting is how many students come into your classes knowing a lot about theology, or at least a particular theology, and very excited about the opportunity of talking about theology. Ad nauseum talking about theology, talking about the theology to the point that I tell them that even though we call this class the Reformation, I lied and we're only going to talk about theology for the first few weeks because their tolerance for it is far higher than mine. I tell them we're going to move right, you know, as quickly as I can away from theology into things that interest me, like death, destruction, sexual deviance, witchcraft, and fun things like that. So the issue is that the segue from the theology to the fun stuff, for me, okay, is the wars of religion. And that's where I get into trouble with my students. And the reason why I get into trouble with my students is because they live in a country that has separation of church and state. They can understand why people would fight over theology. They can understand why people might even resort to fisticuffs over theology, or to, you know, an individual person or a small group might get into a war over theology. But when it comes to what we call the wars of religion, civil wars that tore Europe apart between approximately 1545 until approximately 1648, when the Treaty of Westphalia sort of ended Europe's 30 years wars, in which tens of thousands of people died in Germany alone, hundreds of thousands were displaced. A series of civil wars in France that resulted, among other things, in the 1572 St. Bartholomew's Massacre, in which pregnant women were slaughtered and thrown into the Seine until it ran red with blood. When children running through the streets dragging dead bodies of Protestants behind them to imitate their elders by trying and executing the already dead. How could this happen? And to explain that to students is very difficult because it's baffling. And their bafflement about why it could happen frightens me. And it frightens me because it makes them not see the seeds of similar kinds of attitudes that could grow and germinate in our culture. And they sort of get it if it's, well, they think, well, you know, it's those Muslims over there, because they're over there and they're different from us, and it must be because their religion is fanatical and our religion isn't. And so, you know, whatever our religion might be, okay? And so one of the things that I try to do is to get them to understand how this could happen so that they can understand what a fragile but necessary wall or inoculation the separation of church and state is in our country. And so the first thing that I do is that I upset them horribly by explaining that the wars of religion were only sort of about religion. And so here I move into my personal historical perspective from my years of studying religious wars. How does small-scale violence get turn into a civil war or wars between countries over religion? Simple. They're not about religion. Okay? So that is a big step forward right there. What I mean by that is that when people go to war over religion, it is because that war over religion is in some way linked to power and authority, and in particular, the power of the state. So in other words, Calvinists and Lutherans, or Catholics and Calvinists and Lutherans, or everybody against Jews, were not engaging in this kind of violence simply because they had doctrinal differences over, for example, sola fide, or justification by faith alone, or the priesthood of all believers. Not because those doctrinal issues don't count, but where they count to the point to have civil war or large-scale religious violence is where they intersect with sedition and threats to the power and authority of the state. Okay? And this, first and foremost, is always an issue with people because we like to believe that we do everything, and especially big things like killing off our neighbors, over issues of principle and deep morality. But the thing that, and so what happens then with students is that they'll, is because particularly young people like to see the world in black and white, they say, well, then in that case, the religious issues at the heart of the war must have been a cynical facade. They must not really believe in anything, and it must not be about religion at all. It's just that they're manipulating true believers to gain power or something like this. And then I have to explain, no, people operate through mixed motives. They struggle with their religious beliefs, their moral beliefs, and other sets of more practical and worldly concerns. And these practical and worldly concerns are not separable from their doctrinal beliefs or their moral beliefs. They operate together. And they operated particularly strongly together in the early modern period because of the fundamental belief that coming out of the Middle Ages, and in particular in Catholicism, that kings were priests, and that the whole structure of civil authority in the state relied upon a single doctrinal set of beliefs that linked the people to the ruler and the ruler to God. Okay, so that the ruler of the state was supposed to be a mediator between human beings and God, that a king of France or a Holy Roman Emperor of Germany was as much a priest in the eyes of the people as the Pope. And you cannot understand everything that happens in this period if you do not understand that fundamental issue. Because that's where Protestantism created a problem in the Reformation. Because if you have a belief in the priesthood of all believers, if all people are equally priests, what is the underpinning of the authority of the ruler of the state? And what is going to guarantee that the people are going to follow the laws and be loyal to the ruler? Good question. And what happens in the Reformation, among other things, is that you get a whole variety of different answers. Okay, so how do I illustrate this with my students in a way that they can kind of understand these problems and issues? Well, I like to talk about Martin Luther. Martin Luther, on October 31st, I always love that, Halloween, okay, in 1517, pegged his, or at least is said to have pegged his 95 theses to the door of a church in Wittenberg in Germany, launching the Reformation. Frankly, not that many people read them on the door. It was the copies of them that he sent to Catholic leaders throughout Germany and elsewhere, challenging them to essentially an intellectual debate that really created the problem. And many people have the idea with Lutheranism, and Luther being a real hero of the Protestant Reformation and a great and very brilliant man. He was an Augustinian monk who had a series of revelations that germinated over a long period of time and eventually, resulted in his fundamental beliefs in Lutheranism. Many people have the idea that the religion kind of sprang out of his head like Athena is supposed to have come out of the head of Zeus all at once. Wham, crack open. There's the religion. All set now. Now all we have to do is stay out of the reach of the Inquisition long enough not to get whacked and institute this religion. And, of course, nothing could be further from the truth. Lutheranism alone, just as one branch of Protestantism, had to evolve during the many years. Luther died in 1546, and the religion and the theology, and particularly the attitudes about the relationship between church and state in that one branch of Protestantism alone, had to evolve between 1517 and 1546, and much of it evolved in Luther's mind and with his close collaborators as a result of dealing with the issues, the problems that arise when you move from the theory of doctrine, okay, and theology into implementing it in a state on earth. And there are two issues in particular that Luther had to grapple with that I talk about with my students to help them to understand how these changes could take place. And one of them is the issue of Luther and the Peasants' Revolt from 1524 to 1526, and the other is the issue of Luther and the Jews. Because if we look at how his attitudes evolve on these two crucial issues of his day, we can understand a little bit better some of the things that I'm trying to get at here. Now, Luther, of course, didn't get whacked by the Inquisition because he had a protector, and his protector was Frederick the Wise of Saxony, who was the ruler of Saxony. He was called the Elector, and in a minute you'll find out why. Okay? And many people also think that Frederick the Wise was Luther's first convert to Lutheranism. Well, maybe on his deathbed. Frederick the Wise was, in fact, just the opposite. He had the most tremendous, awe-inspiring collection of bits and pieces of Catholic saints and the true cross and other relics anywhere in Europe. I mean, this was one of the most superstitious. Not only was he Catholic, but he was Catholic in the most old-fashioned sense of being Catholic. And so historians who know this, we love these ironic things we can bring up in the classroom and, wake up our students from time to time, which, you got to do that. Whoa, is anybody there? So we tell them that, Frederick had just the basement of his castle filled with things that were absolutely anathema to Luther. But given the fact that Luther was Saxon and Frederick was willing to protect him, Luther was willing to overlook those evil relics that populated every nook and cranny of Frederick's castle, and Frederick protected Luther. Why did Frederick protect Luther if Frederick himself did not actually buy into Luther's theology, or at least not toward the end of his life? Well, you had a power struggle going on in the Holy Roman Empire. The Holy Roman Emperor belonged to a family called Habsburg. But the title of Holy Roman Emperor was not hereditary. It was elected. And there were seven people. Let's see if I can get the numbers right here. I'm not that good with math, even with low numbers here. Seven electors. Three of them were archbishops. Okay? Then you had several secular leaders, one of whom was Frederick the Wise. Okay? Charles V wanted the title of Holy Roman Emperor. He was a Habsburg. But he had a rival, the King of France. So these two men had already been fighting in Italy over control of Italy, because God forbid you fight at home when you can fight over in Italy and kill them instead. But, you know, over control of this territory. They've been rivals for some time. And so, essentially, Charles V needed votes. Now, of course, we know that, as is often the case in these kind of situations, it wasn't principle, doctrine, or military might that decided the election. It was bribery, okay? And Charles V was lucky because he happened to have a banking family in Germany called the Fugger, who supported him and gave him more bribe money than Francis I had available, okay? But Charles also had to mollify and do political favors for the electors. And so, essentially, Frederick wanted Luther left alone, among other things, because Luther made a very good hostage and potential thorn in the side of Charles, as in, I'll let this guy loose if you mess with me, and basically leave me alone. And essentially, Charles was in too weak a position at that point to do anything other than leave Luther alone. Now, down the road a little bit, Charles does try to put the genie back in the bottle. But 20 years later was 20 years too late, because even though Luther had to be careful about his movements, he was able to build a very large following, and by the time that you have the series of wars of religion that break out in Germany in the 1540s, Charles finds himself in a stalemate, and the result of that stalemate is a peace called the Peace of Augsburg in 1555, which enshrines a doctrine called cuius regio, eius religio, which is Latin for he who rules his religion, which is as close as you get to religious toleration in the period that we're talking about. And we'll come back to cuius regio, eius religio in a minute. So essentially what happens is that Charles retires to a monastery, gives up, divides his empire between his son, who becomes Philip II of Spain, and his nephew Ferdinand, who takes over Germany. Meanwhile, Luther, in all of this period of time, has been struggling with how to set up a church, which is not something that's self-evident, particularly in a time when church and state are closely linked. And again, these two issues of the peasants' revolt and the issue of the Jews give us a sense of the things, the problems that he had to struggle with and the ways in which the link between religion and political loyalty become so paramount. 1524 to 1526, peasants across a broad swath of Germany revolted against their feudal overlords. Nothing new about that. Peasants have been revolting. Well, okay. Peasants have been in the business of uprising for a very, very long time, all throughout the Middle Ages. People who think that the peasants like gamely and passively sat back and just dealt with it, that's not true. They revolt, and this revolt is especially serious because it covers huge parts of territories, and it pits the peasants against the cities, many which own the land in the countryside, and against noble lords. The issue here that makes this revolt different and a problem for Luther is that the peasants took him seriously. Okay? And what I mean by this is that Luther had in his religion has several doctrinal bases, sola fide, or by faith alone, okay, sola scriptura, by scripture alone, and the priesthood of all believers. So if you put this together, what the peasants' reason is that if faith and scripture alone are what ensures salvation, if the hierarchy of the church is unnecessary and actually corrupt and an obstacle to salvation, if the priesthood of all believers really means that everyone, rich and poor, high-born and low-born, okay, alike, are equal in the sight of God and are themselves have a personal relationship with God, then why, the peasants figured, should we be bound by authority of the priests and the monasteries and the nobles who claim to be closer to God than us and who claim to have a divine right to rule over us? And the peasants contact Luther and say, hey, come on, you should be out here fighting for our cause. You should be supporting us. Which creates a real dilemma for Luther, because Luther was, first of all, conservative, okay? And he was conservative in that respect, not only because he himself was from sort of the middling ranks of society, but also because of the fact that he realizes that the support of the ruling classes in Germany is going to be necessary to establish his religion. And, of course, the fact that he's dependent upon the patronage and support of feudal lords like Frederick the Wise to avoid being whacked by the Inquisition. So all of these things kind of come together and lead Luther to have to deal head on with the problem of what is going to be the relationship between church and state if you eliminate the Catholic institutions. And Luther's ultimate result or ultimate conclusion is essentially that true believers have a responsibility to be loyal to the state even if the ruler of that state is a heretic. Now, you also have a responsibility to believe in the true doctrine, and if that results in martyrdom, well, but basically you do not have the right to revolt against your leaders because that would upend the structure of civic authority that holds society together. So Luther had to grapple with these issues. Other religious leaders of the Protestant, various branches of Protestantism, Calvinism, Zwingli, also had to grapple with these issues. And they came up with some different answers. Calvin, for example, said that you could overthrow a heretical ruler, which is one reason why you had a lot of arguments made to this effect in the American Revolution vis-a-vis George III. But once you had a godly ruler, dissent is no longer permitted within the state, which is why Michael Servetus meets the state in Calvin's Geneva rather than in Rome. Well, actually, they caught him there first. So, but anyways, that's why he ends up being martyred there. Okay. Another issue, and I could go on and on, but I don't want to take up a huge amount of time about this, but I could talk endlessly about these issues of church and state in that respect. But I want to move on to the issue of the Jews, because it becomes another problem. How do you tolerate, within a godly commonwealth, a group of people who do not belong to your religion and who stubbornly refuse to join your religion? Well, Luther had two perspectives on this, and essentially his perspective changed over time. At the outset of his Reformation, Luther stated that Luther took a very tolerant attitude toward Jews because his view was the reason why Jews have not converted to Christianity is because the only Christianity they've been exposed to is Catholic Christianity, which is self-evidently corrupt and wrong. And Jews are smart people, and they can see how, you know, off the tracks Catholicism is. So, you know, that's why. And so the real answer here to the problem of the Jews, Luther believed at first, was expose them to the right Protestant theology, and they'll convert. And he had a very optimistic point of view about that until it didn't work. And then he's back with the problem of his writings about the Jews, in other words, become increasingly pessimistic, increasingly intolerant, because he sees them as an obstacle to the unity of the Commonwealth, okay, and to the moral underpinnings of the state, because they obviously are just stubbornly refusing to convert rather than seeing the light now that they've had a chance to see the reformed, correct version of Christianity and convert as a result. Okay, so what I'm getting at with all of this comes back to this issue of cuius regio, eius religio. What you need to understand is that in many places in the world, even today, and for most of the world's history, until the past 250 years, the dominant way in which people thought about the relationship between church and state, at least since the advent of monotheism, has been cuius regio, eius religio. In other words, there's a recognition that you cannot necessarily impose your religion in a universal way upon everybody in other states. But there is a deep discomfort with the idea that you can have within a state people belonging to diverse religious traditions who are all loyal to the state and all operating from a moral basis that has something in common that can allow them all to be equally citizens of the state. What people don't realize, in other words, is that the experiment of church and state in our country of the separation is an experiment, and it is a recent one, and there is no foreordained march of progress in history that is going to guarantee that it is going to become the dominant one or the one that is going to triumph. Why this matters to us as Unitarians is because I believe that Unitarians have an important role to play in this issue. Because I detect, perhaps because I'm used to dealing with these issues in my historical work, a creeping discourse in our country that questions the ability of people whose moral, theological, religious traditions are not Judeo-Christian or are the wrong kind of Judeo-Christian to be trusted to be truly moral people who are loyal citizens of the country who are capable of wielding authority in the country. And I won't say that it's the dominant discourse, and I don't mean to be alarmist about it, but it is there. It has always been there. And I detect in my own lifetime, I'm 45, so I've been around a while to see a few things, I detect an expansion of that discourse. We Unitarians fundamentally reject that discourse because we reject the discourse of a single theology. As our banner, which unfortunately isn't up today, but it sometimes is, we do not need to think alike to love alike. We, as Unitarians, believe that people can be moral and people can be part of the moral community and people can be good citizens with a broad variety of different religious beliefs. So we reject the idea that the religion of the people and the religion of the ruler must be, or the ruling class, shall we say, or the ruling cadre of elected rulers, has to be the same thing. And I get deeply uncomfortable when I see leaders of the polity in our country appeal to a particular set of religious beliefs as a reason for people to support that person as a candidate for office, because I know where that discourse can lead to a sense that people who are not of that religion or not of that set of morals should not be entrusted with authority. And so maybe I'm talking about a slippery slope here, but I guess I'm talking about a slippery slope here. So the issue is that I think it's incumbent upon we Unitarians to work very hard to keep that discourse of separation of church and state alive and keep emphasizing that people with different beliefs can belong to the same community, because we are a model for, in my view, the country as a whole. And the reason we are a model for all of the United States is precisely because there are people in this room that run the gamut from more or less Christian beliefs or more or less beliefs in some other religious tradition to people who are pagan, to people who are agnostic, to people who are atheists, and yet we have faith in each other that we as a community can still work together to do good in the world and to advance some kind of moral or ethical truths and benefits to other people. And I think that it's important for us then to be sensitive to how rare and fragile the experiment of separating church and state of making it so that religious beliefs are not sedition, are not a cause to question the loyalty, the patriotism, the right of a person to belong to a polity, because the result always of that combination is violence, is religious violence. And religious violence that can tear communities apart, can tear nations apart. And we have to get out of our mind the sense that we live in a country that is somehow manifestly destined to continue as it is. Change happens in history, and we need to be careful that we don't sleep while that change happens in ways that we would prefer not to see. Thank you.